The theme for this session of the Futures Foundation Futures Forum is Australia's health system. Although very few of our members actually work in the health sector, we are all at least customers of health services, and conversations with members and among the public more broadly suggest that many feel that the current health system is not achieving what we might want. We're honoured to have as our guest Professor Peter Brooks, who was until recently Executive Director of Research at Northern Health Melbourne and has professorial appointments in the Centre for Health Policy in the School of Population and Global Health within the School of Medicine inside the University of Melbourne. Peter has held professorial positions in a number of universities, including the University of Queensland, New South Wales and Sydney, Flinders University in Adelaide and the University of Tasmania prior to that. Amazing, right around the country. Peter trained originally as a rheumatologist at Monash University and is a frequent commentator on health policy and the importance of developing an evidence base in this area. In 2010, he was awarded membership of the Order of Australia for services to rheumatology as a clinician, researcher and academic. Peter's challenge this evening is to describe what a better health system might look like, and we're very much looking forward to his thoughts. Over to you, Peter.
Thanks, Charles. This is a small group, so I'm very happy if people want to chip in as we go along, rather than leave questions all to the end, but we'll see how things go. What I thought I'd do is, because I think it's important just to put things into context, we are thinking about the future, but in a way, I think we need to just understand a little bit about the health system as it is at the moment, because the future, in my view, and I hope I'll be able to show that to you, could be very close for us in health, if only we didn't have any health professionals stopping it. You're not allowed to laugh at that. Okay, so what I want to do is, as I said, just to talk a little bit about the system that we have at the moment. The problem is we don't have a health system, really, in my view. We have an ill system. We focus very much on acute illness. Chronic illness is starting to catch on, but it's really acute episodes of care in chronic illness or in somebody who's got just having acute illnesses, and it's basically a waiting list, you know. It's a waiting. If you've got a problem, you want to see a doctor or a physiotherapist or whatever, you know what happens. You ring up and they can give you an appointment. Very rarely can you see somebody immediately. They'll give you an appointment. If it's a consultant, you might see them in 3 or 4 months' time. Well, you know, you've actually got a problem now. The health system is complex, and I think one of the problems is, and is that health professionals are wonderful at saying, listen, this system is so complex, the only people that can fix it is ourselves. We can't have other people coming in and helping us. And I'm not really sure whether that's correct. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's not correct. and that's one of the problems. We don't really focus enough on outcomes. We do things, but we're not really as much as we should be focused on what we should be producing, whether it's a cure or a control or whatever. And the other thing I'd say is that as we go forward into the future, I think we must accept that health and health are intimately related. We don't do enough of that. You know, most of us enter this world reasonably normal, but it takes a relatively short period of time to become abnormal. And so that link between wellness and health is something that you're seeing a lot of it talked, interestingly, by the non-medical side of the profession. But it's so important. You know, if we don't take that holistic view of our bodies, then we're not actually going to be able to get where we want to go. So, we know why we're here at this point in time with this crisis. You know, at least I think politicians over the last probably 3 or 4 years have realised that there is a crisis. a lot of people have been telling them this for at least 20 years. And I mean, I was pretty appalled last year when, I think it was last year, or perhaps earlier this year, when our Premier went to that big meeting that they all had in Canberra and came out of it and said, you know, we've got a crisis. Well, he was the bloody health minister for a while. He should have known that. You know, it's not rocket science, because we're getting all these old folk who are requiring care. Not necessarily a lot of care, but they are requiring care, and care is becoming more and more costly. So those sorts of issues, and you know, this is the ABS demographic predictions for 2051, and you could, the number of 85-year-olds, as you saw, 85 plus, goes up incredibly, and we're going to have, I think it's 1.5 million people over the age of 85, 2025 or something. So these are real issues, not necessarily, and many of those people are going to want to stay at home, and that's absolutely appropriate for them. They do not need, they hopefully do not need to be in care. And the other thing, and I'm sure you've all heard this, that there's much more pressure now on getting people out of hospital. But, and we'll discuss this a little bit, there are real issues, because in this wonderful country we have two totally different funding streams for out-of-hospital care and in-hospital care, one the Commonwealth Government and one the state government or state governments. And so, you know, it's really hard to, you know, the gaming, as you know, is just, it's an art form in this country, how you can put the bill onto somebody else. So we've got ageing, we've got chronic disease. 30 to 40% of chronic diseases are caused, are really a direct result of obesity. And if you want my money, that's the problem. Coca-Cola. And we... I did notice that. I thought, how can I take this slide out? But if you're coming to dinner, I can tell you some real stories about Coca-Cola and how they've just set up an organisation around the world. You probably don't know this, but which was called the Global Energy Balance Network. Now, this was a wonderful organisation funded entirely by Coca-Cola to get scientists who should have more sense, to get up there on the podium like me and say, listen, we're not really sure about this business of Coca-Cola and sugar. Might be there, but really it's you're not doing enough exercise. And there was another mob about 20 years ago called the Tobacco Research Foundation, which 20 years after Richard Dollar showed very clearly that smoking caused lung cancer, said, well, we're not really sure about this. We've got to get more data. And so, but this is outrageous. And in fact, yesterday, the scientific director of Coca-Cola was forced to resign. Good. So should the whole board. Anyway, I'll just tell you a little aside, because there's on the 2013 website of Coca-Cola Australia, there was an ad, which it was a slide which said, we are very proud to announce that the Northern Territorians drink more Coke per head than anybody, not just in Australia, but in the world. And they were very proud of that. Now that ad was removed when it was pointed out to them that was not good community service. But that's the sort of thing that big business does. So we've got to be very careful of what I call the medical industrial complex. But that's another talk. Unrealistic expectations for the community. We've caused this problem, we the health professionals, because, you know, how many times a week do you hear that we've got a cure for cancer? At least 5. If you're listening to a lot of television, you'll probably hear it 10. But, you know, this is silly. But it's the competitive environment that we have. You know, every research institute's trying to cure cancer, so they need funding. They've got to get out there. And, you know, you really have to say that this has probably not helped society. Unrealistic expectations. Medical industrial complex, we talked about the fact that because we're so, and patients demand it to a certain extent, we're so driven to provide that cure or control that doctors will use a new treatment which might increase the chance of cure or usually control by, you know, 0.2%, and it'll have 3% less side effects. But it costs $1 million. Irrelevant. Because I'm not paying for it. I, the doctor, I'm not paying for it. Medicare's paying for it, or more importantly, the other patient. And the patient thinks, you know, I need my health, so I must have this, and the doctor says it's good. Now, I think this is not rational. And the other thing, which is to the fore at the moment, because you're all aware of this new review of the medical benefit schedule items, looking at things that are not evidence-based. And I've been very much involved in this over the years, and I think most of us who've been at the coalface would say that probably up to 30% of things that we do in healthcare don't actually make a significant difference. And that goes right from arthroscopies, which I know about being a rheumatologist, to stents when you've just had one episode of angina, to knee replacements when you're overweight and you might be able to put the operation off for 2 or 3 years if you get into an exercise program and things like that, or to things that we do in the last year of life. And I'll show you some data on that. And so it brings in, I was delighted to see in your next year's, one of your next year's talks is a talk on how we leave the planet, because it's probably the most important, certainly at my age, it's one of the most important decisions that we make, and I want to leave it when I want, and in not very much pain. And if somebody can help me do that, that's good. Have you all signed advance directives? We've got a slide on that later on. So we've got this problem of sustainability, and this is the sustainability gap. The demand for health services, which is going up, driven by chronic disease and ageing, and this the funding for health. And we've got to be realistic. I mean, I'm also a member of the Doctors for the Environment, and I think that my view, it's a different subject, you might disagree with me, but I think that these things that I see on the front page of the AFR saying we're only going to have a 1 to 2% growth rate are fantastic. Because if we have a 5, 7% growth rate, then we'll fry about 2035 or 2045. If we have a 3% growth rate, we might last till 2070. But if we have a 1% growth rate, we might actually go on forever. And I don't want to do that myself, but I want my kids, I want a planet for my kids. So, but what I'm saying is that growth rate is going to affect the amount of money that governments have got to put into health. So we've got to do things smarter. We work, Productivity Commission report into health 2206, which I think is probably one of the best documents on health workforce. It's on the Productivity Commission workforce website. But they clearly show that the health system, particularly the public system, I think the private system is probably a little bit better, but not much, was running in 2006 about 25% inefficient. So it's probably only, I think we've done a little bit, but we haven't done very much. We could do a lot better. So if you look at pulling back that productivity gap, then we've got money to put into changing the system, but we need to change. How we fund it? It's $135 billion. It's increasing pretty rapidly, 5% per annum. About 50% of Australians have private insurance. And in a way, I think it's a healthy mix in Australia of private and public, but I think it's getting a little out of whack if we're not careful. The big thing is out-of-pocket expenses. That's what you pay the doctor over and above what the Medicare rebate provides for you. And that's now running at $28 billion a year. And those who are, some data last year showing those 65 plus are spending about $3,500 a year out of their own pocket on health care. Now, you know, you can say, well, that's fine, but, you know, this is, I always ask doctors, and nobody's given me a good answer yet, why are there three rates? Why is there a Medicare rate for an item, you know, a procedure or a consultation? Why is there the AMA rate, which is about 50% of what the Medicare rate is, And then why is there your rate, which is what you charge the patient, which is usually outrageous? And we were talking earlier that, you know, out-of-pocket expenses for cataracts, which are between $3,000 and $5,000 per eye for 20 minutes work. I mean, it's daylight robbery. And it's not the profession, I can tell you, that I went into. You can see how popular I am. I'm not usually invited to AMA talks. The MBS is very procedurally based, so that it's much easier to earn $1 million if you're a surgeon, or, in fact, you do that. Most surgeons would do that working 2 days a week. I kid you not. But sitting down and spending an hour with a patient deciding that they actually don't need an operation, that there are other ways of doing things. Your Medicare rebate, I think the Medicare item number for that's about $220, whereas for the same, for the operation to do the knee, the knee replacement that you don't really need, you'd probably be paying between $3,000 and $8,000. And in a way, that could be what the what some people think the MBS review might help to fix, but I don't think so. We tried to do that with what we call the relative value study a few years ago, but it didn't work. But, you know, at some stage it's going to have to happen. The gap between GPs and specialists in terms of pay in this country is the second highest gap in the world. I think we have almost the most wealthy doctors in the world, the best paid doctors in the world in Australia. But the gap is between, it's about a factor of four, but 4 to 5, but the GPs, the non-procedurals, this is OECD figures, kick in at about 250,000. So you've got your specialists kicking in at $1.5 million. And, you know, I can tell you there aren't too many specialists that are at that end. They're mostly higher up. But what it is doing is it's affecting career choice. I mean, you know, medical students are not stupid. They get through now with their increased fees, university fees, and they see that they can be an ophthalmologist and pay this back in about, 3 weeks. Or they can be a general practitioner and work at the weekends in rural Australia and have just a wonderful job and contribute enormously. But they'll take 10 years to pay it back. So it's becoming an issue, and people are really not taking that on board. I've talked about the mind the gap issue, because mind the gap does mean something different here from Houston's, what it does at Houston Station. International comparisons of spending, we're not too bad. We're about the OECD average, but people should remember the US is, everybody says, oh, the US is hopeless, you know, it's 17%, it's so far ahead of us. Actually, the US, in their 17%, at least 2% of that is medical training, because their medical training, and I wasn't aware of this until I was talking to the States once and I put up these figures, and they said, well, hang on, it's slightly different. So it might be, it's an average of sort of 15 to 10 or 11 in our case, or it's 17 to 13. So it's not quite as bad. It's still a gap, and a lot of their stuff, I think, goes on administrative costs, but you know, it's an interesting system. Distribution of the health dollar, you can see the hospitals, medical services take up most. Research, about 4%. Community health, 5%. Medicines are increasing with the increasing cost of medicines, and of course, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the free trade, nothing's free, free trade agreement does to that. Community health, we spend, when you look at public health and prevention, it's pathetic in terms of what we spend on. It's the sort of health balance. And this low-value care, which I mentioned, you know, potential savings of 20 to 30 billion there, we wouldn't get that much savings initially, but over a period of time, if we were really serious about this. But this has got to be done with the profession, because otherwise we're not going to win. And I think already you're seeing an enormous backlash from the AMA. See, the AMA doesn't want to be part of this. I think I'm not sure whether I saw a press release a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not sure whether they've come back to the table. a lot of the proceduralists are getting upset and saying this is all political. Well, it's not. This is about patients. What I say is, if you are doing an operation which is what we call low value, or a procedure that's low value, i.e. it doesn't value add, it doesn't alter the way that patient's going to be managed. It's all very well to do the operation. It's another thing to do the operation and charge an out-of-pocket expense. It's another thing to do the procedure, charge an out-of-pocket expense, and cause the patient an adverse event. And everything has the potential for an adverse event. And so, you know, it's doctors don't seem to get that, but this is serious. And I think it won't happen until people actually start saying, why did you do this arthroscopy when, you know, everybody says it's not worth it? And then, as I was talking to somebody last week, they said, well, that's interesting. My father-in-law had an arthroscopy last year. He was 75 or something. And he died a day later because he got a deep vein thrombosis, which is a common complication. And you know what? This person, a very senior person, not in the health sector, said to me, and I didn't really sort of point out what the issue was, but he said, because it happened so quickly after the operation, it was a post-mortem, and my grandmother, or my mother-in-law, was surprised that the knee was normal, which you would expect. So, you know, this happens all the time, and we've got to stop it. You can stop it. The cost in the last year of life, we just mentioned this en passant. I mean, in Australia, still, data is pretty clear. About 70% of people want to die at home, but we only let about 30%. It's improving, but the resources out in the community for letting people die at home are not there, and they should be there. Data from New South Wales a couple of years ago, looking at the the costs in the 6 months before death were about $650. The costs in the last month before death were $5,500. Now, this is, you know, you're not in health, but you are. But this is not a value proposition. It's silly. So this issue about advanced directives, I think, is really important. And we're not doing too bad in this country, but, and particularly in Victoria, and I think some of the initiatives that the Victorian government have taken recently to get people to think about this are really important. But it's something we're all going to have to face. So the challenge is we've got this disconnect between in-hospital and out-of-hospital funding that I mentioned before, between the Commonwealth and the states. In my view, there's lack of national and state leadership. I mean, it's really sad that nobody has the guts to. I love my profession, but I'm really disappointed by the way we handle things. You know, the AMA is very powerful. It's the most powerful union in this country, and I've told health ministers seriously that they shouldn't be frightened of the AMA, because there are only two examples in the world where doctors have gone on strike, and guess what happens? The death rate goes down. and it stays down for about 10 days, and then it sort of starts to go up again. But seriously, doctors are pretty good folk. They'll probably go back to work on day 7, so you're okay, but you've got to hang in there. You cannot give in to them. Gutless, they've never done it. I think that, and it's our own fault, I think there has been an alienation of health professionals in terms of how the health system is administered. I think that's a balance because, as I was saying, I think it's important that, I mean, I believe very much in clinician leaders and people who understand about the system, the health system, but also understand about good governance and realise that this system is not about keeping health professionals in their jobs. This system, this health system that we have, is about looking after patients. And we forget that. Because we live in this wonderful democracy, we have, as you know, umpteen lobby groups. We're no different from any other profession, probably, but we do it in spades. I mean, one example in Canada, you have there is a College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada, and that person, the president, is the head of all of the physicians, all of the specialist doctors in Canada. Here, what do we have, 43 or 45 colleges? So it's pretty easy for the government to find one of them that agrees with them, and they just pick us off. It's just crazy. And we don't really engage with the community. And I will come back and talk about this, because I think this is a real exciting thing for the future and may well be the thing that drives the profession to do something. And I'll explain that later. But, you know, it's... So, one of the most important things we have in the health system is the workforce. If we don't have a workforce, then we don't have a health system. And I got interested in this and set up the Australian Health Workforce Institute about 10 years ago when I came down from Brisbane. And this was really looking at the sort of, the numbers, but numbers, unfortunately, in this country, and probably around the world, if you look at, you know, you say, how many doctors do we need, how many nurses do we need, etc. But what people do is they predicate those data on the models of care that we have today. Well, you can't do that. Well, futurists wouldn't do that. So you need to get into talk to these folk. But it's really saying, look, what could we do in 2025, 2030, and then saying, these are the services we want to deliver, we want to be able to deliver in 2035, and this is how we're going to deliver, and what we're going to deliver. And then you say, well, how do we deliver them? What people do we need to, who do we need to train, and what skills do we need? And workforce is not, it's not rocket science. I mean, you need the right skills in the right place, the right time, at the right cost. And so much of what we do in the health system, we overtrain people. There's a wonderful scenario, you'll see this going on over the next week or so, because I see that the Victorian government announced that it's going to do some trials on getting pharmacists to deliver more healthcare. Okay? So you won't need to go to see the GP, you can go and get your scripts done by the, repeat scripts perhaps done by the pharmacist. It was only announced yesterday, so I haven't actually seen the thing, but I noticed some of the Twitterati were on this morning saying that, you know, just making derisory comments saying that, you know, seeing a, I think there was one that by the time this bloke had got past the complementary medicines and the shampoos to the pharmacist, he decided to go and see his GP. Well, that might be a good thing, but, you know, pharmacists are extraordinarily well trained. I used to run a school of pharmacy in Queensland, and yet they sell beauty products a lot of the time. It's silly stuff, you know. They're the health professional that has more contact with the community than any other. So we could use them as, you know, in terms of public health messages. I mean, we know if we take an example from the smoking thing, the smoking issue, that your GP just saying to you every time you went to the GP, are you still smoking? It didn't stop you smoking, but it did have an effect. And if you did that with, you know, if you were overweight or whatever, you know, you could think of lots of ways where the pharmacist could help. And we'll come back and talk about this when we talk about a virtual health system. I mean, it really makes me angry that you know, I have to go to see my GP to get a repeat of my antihypertensive medication, which I've been on for, you know, 3 years or whatever. I mean, it's pathetic.
So I hear that rant every month for my wife.
Yeah, exactly. And why? A lot of the doctors don't even. Well, the most common communicate. I think I'm still right here. The most common way of communicating with GPs, anyway, is still the fax machine. I believe you heard of them. We used to have them around. I mean, this is unreal. Absolutely unreal. Anyway, so there's a couple of health workers. Our opportunity now is with this. You know, I want to run my health on my iPhone, and I could do it if doctors would would participate, if health workers would participate. And we're doing it slowly but surely. But this is the opportunity that we have now. And I fear, and we'll talk, I want to sort of finish by talking about patient participation, because, see, participatory health is about patients firstly knowing a little bit about health and their own health, their bodies, and what can be done and what the options are. So health literacy obviously has to improve. But then being able to have a rational conversation with their health professional, whether it's a doctor, physiotherapist, or what, and saying, look, these are the options. And having looked at those options, then making a joint decision about how you need to be cared for. What I fear, if we're not careful, is that a lot of patients are going to say, there are a lot of people out there who are already into this. They consult Dr. Google, whatever. This is what they'll do. They say, why do I need a bloody doctor? I'll just go straight to Dr. Google. I'll see what I've got. I've got all the symptoms. Yep, got my diagnosis. I'll go to the pharmacist and get some tablets. That's not participatory medicine, is it? I mean, they're not participating with the doctor or with their other health workers. So that that would be just as bad. Now, there's some really exciting things. This is not I'm sorry the slide's a bit small, but this is not an ad for Telstra. But if you look at the Telstra website, Telstra Health is interesting. I'm not sure whether they've got the solution. In fact, they haven't had the solution for any of the other things that I've done with Telstra, so this will be a first, but I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. They are really getting heavily into this health space. They're buying up companies that they've got some great platforms for telehealth. They've got you can do all your bookings on with them. So they're developing these platforms as a sort of one-stop shop. They've got information. They bought up a couple of health information companies. They've got there's a thing called My Health Point, which is for chronic condition management. And care management, which is looking at how you keep people in their homes long. So they're doing all the right things, whether these things work or not. They are trialling them at the moment. But and I think it's really exciting. That's the sort of Telstra health ecosystem that they talk about. And in fact, I think we have to think the health system of 2025, if it's not a virtual health ecosystem, then we're in deep trouble. We really are in deep trouble. Because I just can't believe that we won't be doing so much of this stuff online. I have I'm looking for my mobile phone. I have a friend in New York who looks after diabetics. He's an endocrinologist, and he works in downtown New York. And a lot of the kids that he works with are street kids. He sees them once, usually in a coffee shop, and he runs their whole practice, their whole treatment on this. He has their blood sugars, all their other parameters, blood pressure, etc., plugged into this. He knows how much insulin they're taking. He can send them messages. it's extraordinary. And it's not rocket science. There are platforms which allow you to do this. And, these are some of the things that Telstra Health are doing. I think a lot of people out there would say, look, I'm very happy to pay for this. I'd be happy to have to pay for a 10-minute consultation with my GP on this if it meant that I didn't have to spend an hour or 50 minutes driving across town to see him, because he can do the, I see in 10 years' time, I'll be able to do the consultation on this. He'll be able to e-script my script to the local pharmacist, which is just around the corner, or perhaps across town. It might be Sunday morning, I'm doing it through a locum service. And then the drone from the pharmacy will deliver my my tablets to my front door. It's happening in the US. Anyway, just a little bit on health workforce shortage, because this is important stuff for us, particularly the bottom bit. This is some work that was done by Health Workforce Australia a few years ago. looking at health workforce shortages in 2025. They were pretty smart because they did do a few scenarios. So, you know, I've just given you the do-nothing scenario versus the productivity gains of 5%. But the number of doctors required goes down from being nearly 3,000 doctors short if we do nothing about productivity to having nearly 3,000 doctors too many if we actually get our act together. Now, if we haven't got our act together by 2025, we don't deserve to be here. And so, you know, building new medical schools, which happened under our last Prime Minister Captain's call, is not evidence-based. Nurses, we've got a problem. Even if we retain 5% and more in the workforce, because this is a problem, a lot of nurses do nursing when they drop out and do other things, and some of them come back. We're still 90,000 nurses short by 2025. I'll tell you what's going to happen. I mean, that will be... I was in the UK last year talking to one of the people, in senior person in the NHS, talking about aged care. And this guy said to me, look, Peter, if you need aged care in England at the moment, you need to have a little bit of money because the NHS package doesn't really cover you. And he said, but there's one other thing too. You need to speak Filipino, because all the nurses in the nursing homes in the UK are Filipino. And perhaps that's a good thing, perhaps it's not. But it's happening here too, because again, we pay aged care nurses pence, much less than we pay nurses in the acute sector. So, I mean, those things really need to be looked at. But the big thing is carers. This is Productivity Commission report of 2012. they came out pretty clearly, and it was based on some really quite good data, suggesting that we'll have a shortage of carers, that's carers in the community, of 600,000 by 2018. Now, this is next week. Now, I can tell you that the health department, I don't know whether the Victorian Health Department's done anything, but I can tell you the Commonwealth Health Department's done absolutely nothing. Well, you're going to have to be careful, because this is going to be on somebody's next watch. Again, you know, we don't need to, it's not rocket science. Looking after a patient who's elderly is fine. We need to have very slick training programs. They're part of a team. They can be connected on these things to other health professionals. But you know what's happening I think there is at least one trial being done now in Australia. But what's happening overseas is, because they've got exactly the same problem with carers, particularly the Japanese, what are they doing? Putting robots in there. And what happens, it's fantastic, because, you know, if you're a carer and you're looking after somebody who's a bit demented, and they know that the demented person knows they've got an appointment at midday, well, they'll ask every 5 minutes, you know, is it time to go yet? Well, the carer gets pretty sick of about the 10th time they're asked. The robot just responds, don't worry, we're going at 12 o'clock. Don't worry, we're going at 12 o'clock. So they don't get upset at all. And they don't need to take sick leave or anything like that. So perhaps that's the way we should go. Or we'll have to go. We may not have an option. So gaps in the workforce. We talked a little bit about... I think we're going to need a range of health assistance. I think you'll find in 2025 that you'll probably have... We'll have care assistants, and we'll have like health navigators, somebody who you'll go to who, if you've got a chronic disease certainly, who will try and coordinate all of your care say, look, you know, this is the best bang, you can get the best bang for your buck here from this doctor or from that physiotherapist or whatever. Better use of pharmacists, we talk about that. I talk about downskilling a little bit as well, because, you know, and unfortunately I'm in the trained primarily, I've worked primarily in the tertiary sector, and it's a problem because, you know, what we really need out there in the health sector are people who, we need health navigators, we need carers. Now, I can't persuade Glenn Davis, Vice Chancellor of Melbourne University, or even the Dean, to deliver a course on caring. you know, it's just not on because they can't see their, that it's going to improve their research output or think something like that. So it's a bit of a dilemma. There is a disjuncture between, you know, what the universities produce and what the community actually needs. And I think, and we see that particularly in the mix of specialists versus generalists. So, Grattan Institute, at least somebody agrees with me, that they had a, some of the stuff that Stephen Duckett's done I think is really very good on looking at, this was a paper on unlocking skills in hospitals. So it was looking at hospitals and saying, how can we become more productive? You know, having nurse assistants there doing basic care rather than necessarily registered nurses. So what do we do in this state? I don't know, have we actually, has the government legislated it yet? But they, Sanders got in really because he told the nurses union that they were going to legislate this ratio didn't he, from?
Yeah, he's done it.
Has he already done it?
Yeah, well, to my understanding, yes. Yeah.
Okay, well, if he's done it.
The patient ratio,
yes,
per nurse, yeah, I think it was about a month ago.
Yeah, I thought he had. Yeah. See, this makes the most rigid health system you can have. And it's silly, but, you know, that's evidence-based. I'm not saying any notice of the evidence.
Labour governments make promises to unions.
Yeah, that's right. Specialist nurses doing things like endoscopy and sedation. We've been running some programs recently trying to persuade gastroenterologists that nurse practitioners could do endoscopies. There's a training program, and it's actually going reasonably well. It's sort of slowly catching on, but it's a war zone because what happened was that they set this up in Queensland. I was party to setting up the simulation process for training the nurses. The chief nurse in Queensland who decided that what she would do is get one of the universities which didn't have a medical school to run the program, and when she set up the program she said, I don't want any doctors on the management committee. Now, you know, this is sort of silly stuff. And I think we've sort of resolved it now, but, you know, it's there's absolutely no reason. If you go for an endoscopy in Britain, for screening endoscopy, you'll have it done by a nurse practitioner, who's nurse endoscopist, who actually works with the gastroenterologist. And in fact, the studies that have been done suggest that the nurses are actually better at picking up polyps than doctors. Allied health assistants. Now, and I always fight with the physiotherapists or the allied health people about this because, see, if you've got a chronic disease, if you're over the age of 60 and you've got four chronic diseases, which is what the average Australian over the age of 60, 65 has, then is it sensitive? Do you really need to go and see an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, a speech pathologist and a whatever? Probably 60, 70% of that stuff could be handled by the generalist. But you try and say to a physiotherapist, we want you to train physio assistants. They think it's denigrating the profession. And it's just silly stuff. They're not, again, they're interested purely and simply in the profession rather than saying what will help the patient. It's just a... So, training the health workforce of the future. I'll speed up a little bit here. I just wanted to show you a couple of things because I think this is quite exciting work. This is using simulation, and we'll be using a lot more simulation for training health workers. As you know, a lot of other industries use simulation. But these are the sort of skills that you get that we're going to need, particularly communication skills, professional skills, and you know, being a scholar, but using evidence-informed decisions. The simulation, how do we train? Well, just very briefly, when I was a medical student, the average length of stay in hospital was about 10 days. Patients came in 2 days before they had their operation to get their deep vein thrombosis and talk to the students, and they spent about 4 days, 5 days after the operation talking to the students. So they were great. And they weren't all that sick. I mean, not like now. Nowadays, the average length of stay is, what, 3.5 days? Most people who are in a hospital have many other things wrong with them. They're sick people. I always think it's unethical to train students on many of these patients. So we're moving much more to simulation. And Confucius knew this a few years ago. Tell me and I will forget, show me and I may remember, involve me, get me to do it and watch me and I will understand. And so, you know, no more is it the sage on the stage, it's very much the sort of guide on the side. And how you do that in the health space is really interesting. We actually use simulation quite a lot, these sort of simulations quite a lot, whether it's case studies or role-playing or computer-based stuff. I mean, mannequins, the sort of high-level models where you have a model that has a blood pressure and a heartbeat and all that sort of stuff, which costs $1 million, you don't actually need that for much of the stuff. But as I said, you know, the airline industry's used it for years, geospatial work. I mean, interestingly, you see, Qantas now, if you're a Qantas pilot, you have 5 weeks off work. You have to go to into the flight simulator and take off and land two planes before you get back in the pilot seat. My orthopaedic surgeon can have 5 weeks skiing in Courchevel in France. He can get on the midnight special from London, arrive at Tullamarine at 6 o'clock in the morning, go straight to St. Vincent's and operate. Nothing stops him. Now, I've talked to them about this, and they're actually better.
That's
because they've had a holiday.
First class.
What?
That's because he was flying first
but,
class.
But they've had a holiday. They've had a rest, so they're pretty. They're much better than they were before. The thing is, it's a testable hypothesis, you see, and I suspect that you'd find that they perhaps work. But anyway, it'll come. It should come. Sport, agriculture, architecture, used all over the place. The simulation is really good for debriefing, for improving the quality and safety agenda. And, you know, all of us find ourselves on this planet every now and again in situations that we don't particularly like. Like this bird, and of course Captain Sullenberger, the guy that landed in the Hudson River, he had simulated flying into a flock of birds. And the other thing they didn't say on the website is that he was also a superb glider pilot, so that probably helped him too. But you know, it's that those sorts of things that really do improve health training. So we do it in all sorts of things. That's dentistry. There are four at least dental schools in Japan that only teach dentistry by simulation. You never see a patient. You don't need to if you're a dentist and talk to patients. Do you really? Just finally on this slide, and then we'll go on to the last set. The very interesting study that was done last year in America, where they looked at simulation in the nursing space. So they took nurses who normally could have up to about 10% of their course could be delivered by simulation. And they said, what would happen if we divided these nurses into three groups? First group had just went on and did their normal training with up to 10% simulation. Second group had 25% simulation. And the third group had 50% substitution of their clinical work for simulation. And it was there were 250 nurses in each of the groups, multiple outcome measures. And very quickly, the national exam rates were unaffected by substitution, all the same. They followed the patients through the, they're shown to be equally prepared for practice. And when they followed them in that first year of practice, they found that the nurses in the simulation groups, where 25 and 50% simulation had been substituted, were just as good at relating to patients as the others. So, you know, it's something we've got to think about, because that would make an enormous difference in terms of how we change the nursing curriculum. Finally, on simulation, the other thing is, which is the real issue, in a way I'm sort of over simulation in education, it works, there's good studies. The real interest is simulation driving productivity. And I'll give you three examples. If you give a surgeon, because surgeons work by eye-hand coordination a lot of the time, but if you give them one of those little Wii devices to play around with before they go into theatre for about 10 minutes, you can reduce their operating time without compromising safety by about 20%. For simple operations, and you know, we need to be doing that with bigger operations as well. Mayo Clinic had a problem a few years ago with intravenous lines getting infected and spending quite a lot of money with patients having to stay in and getting septicemia, etc. So they said, right, before you put a line in any patient at this Mayo Clinic, big hospital in the States, we want you to simulate it beside the patient's bed. It takes you 4 minutes. You've got a little mannequin with a vein, you stick it in plastic, stick it in, and then you go and do it in the patient. They saved $1.5 million in the first year. They reduced their bed stay by nearly a day because they were getting far fewer infections, patients were getting out of hospital quickly, all this sort of stuff. Everybody's happy. Third thing is really exciting, and there's only one study on this, and I can't find anybody that has got the guts to repeat it, but if you're running an ICU unit, what you need to do is to close one of your beds and you put a mannequin in there. Because you know that you're going to be called to say, look, we're getting a patient there, there'll be a patient at the hospital in 20 minutes, we've just picked him up from the side of the road, motorcyclist, got two very smashed legs, caved in chest, and he's lost an arm, and he's got a head injury. You get your team working on that mannequin for 20 minutes before the patient arrives. And when the patient hits the ward, you've done it all. And you know what? It takes you 2 weeks to improve your throughput of the ICU by 20% in the two studies that have been done. But you must never close the bed. Problem there is for the public relations officer at the hospital, because what's going to happen? 4 weeks down the track, you've got your bed, you've still got your mannequin in the bed, and the headline in the paper, because there was a bypass, ambulance bypass yesterday at Royal Melbourne, and Gareth's trying to explain why he's got these ambulance bypasses, but he's got dummies in his beds. So, but those sorts of things I think are really exciting and will help to drive systems. Okay, so let's fast forward. Let's use this technology-enabled solution, because we could do it now. We still worry about privacy and security. Forget it. You know, I mean, we worried about our bank accounts. We've had a hole in the wall. Interesting little aside story. Kaiser Permanente last year put $3.5 million, I think it was, medical records. They got approval from their clients to put them up on the cloud, and they just followed what happened to them. And within 6 months, 65% of people had shared their record with somebody who wasn't even in the family. So, you know, I think this is it's a furphy. The hospital mobility and consumer engagement are going to drive this. And now you can get the best opinions from somebody in the United States. It'll cost you a bit of money, and it may not be the best way to go, but you can do that from Melbourne, and people do. They're doing it now. So let's not kid ourselves that this isn't here now. These are the sorts of things that are available, and this was 2 years ago. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of measurement tools that can measure your blood pressure, how much walking you're doing, how many of you have Fitbits or smart watches. But what I usually do is I say, how many of you got Fitbits? And then the next question, how many of you actually use them? And there's a big difference between the number that have them and the number that use them. But, you know, we've got things there. I mean, imagine I'm running the best health insurance company of 2025. But to do this, I give you low rates because you're pretty fit, but I've got linked up to all sorts of technology. You do have mild diabetes and you're just a little bit overweight, but I'm monitoring because you're getting this low rate, you've given me permission to monitor all your parameters. And I notice that after 3 or 4 weeks, you've actually put on a bit of weight and you're not doing as much walking. And you've got this low premium. So you get a little text message saying, right, well, you've got 3 weeks to correct this, because if you don't, and you're locked into me because you can't go to see somebody else because it'll be a prior illness, your premium's going to go up by 50%, you see. So that's how I run the insurance company. It'll happen. Solutions like that, not necessarily that one. You know, the fact that portable imaging biomarkers, I talk a lot to the genomics folk, and I'm not totally convinced that we're going to get to the system situation where you can take a bit of blood when you're 3 days old and be told that you're going to die of cancer or you're going to get your bowel cancer when you're 43 and have your first heart attack when you're 62. I don't think we're going to get that sophisticated. Certain diseases, yes. You know, we know things. There are very strong predictors for things like breast cancer and some colon cancers. But it's in evolution. But using things for prevention, as we were talking about before, or monitoring chronic disease, fantastic. And then that sort of global access to healthcare services. And I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with things like the Pacific Free Trade Agreement. You know, will we find that Kaiser Permanente puts up a bid for Medicare? Well, you know, it might not be silly thought. Anyway, there are now, it's actually, that slide's wrong, there's 100,000 mobile apps on your that you can get for your iPhone now. And it's going up dramatically. By 2016, there'll be about 10 billion mobile devices on the planet, so that tells you that there'll be a number of folk who have two or three. One for each mistress. This is, if you want to look up stuff on what we call mHealth, the Brookings Institute report, if you Google Brookings Institute and look at Gary West, mHealth it's called, it's a fantastic report, and it hasn't changed all that much in terms, except for perhaps the numbers. But they've done some really interesting figures suggesting these incredible savings, 25% reduction in cost of medical care in the elderly, and productivity gains of over $300 billion over 10 years. So these are not small figures. The market revenue for apps, for health apps in 2013 was $2.4 billion. By 2017, it's expected to be $26 billion. Now, one of the problems with these apps is you don't have to test them to show that they work, really. And so we're going to have the same sort of issue about evidence-based healthcare is going to arise with them. Because anybody can put an app out. And in the States, what happens is people either buy it and use it, or it goes down the gurgler. But you find out fairly quickly, and you become either a millionaire or you try and develop the next app. But a critical analysis of whether it really helps you as a patient has been done on very few of them. And, you know, we need to do that. Those sorts of things need to be done. We've talked about some of the new technologies, the robots, and they will make a big difference. They're already working in back office stuff. But Google Glass, the Google Glasses is phenomenal. I mean, that I need one now. I've always had a terrible memory for names, and you know, you can actually get these things where you can store all the photographs of the people you know and you. In your glasses, and then you have, as you're walking down the street, Charles approaches, and the name Charles Brass scrolls across my glasses. Charles, how are you? It's really interesting, and there are already studies showing that you can use this in mildly demented patients to save them, to stop them from getting lost, and enable them to stay at home much longer than they can at now. So. And just finally, the thing on telehealth. Again, a real and I when I went to Queensland, I set up the Centre for Online Health, and we've now gone on and got one of these big research grants on setting up a Centre for Research Excellence in telehealth. But what we've tried to do there is to look at the sorts of ways that you can better prepare a patient and a doctor to do a telehealth consultation. What are the sort of things that you need? What are the platforms you need? What are the funding mechanisms that would incentivise these sorts of things, cost effectiveness of telemedicine protocols, and it's been very useful. But you see, the government unfortunately has said you have to be 40 kilometres apart before you can get reimbursed, and it's reimbursement at the moment is between doctor and doctor, or patients with one doctor. But you know, do you really need that doctor? Could you do it with a nurse, or could you do it directly with the patient? You won't get reimbursed for it. you could charge now, but you can't get reimbursed for it. But you know, those sorts of things, when you think about the savings that are there, would be something for the government to think about. We're always told we can't do this. Here's Toronto, 2010. They had some real problems, and they did these few things. They expanded information technology, because that's the whole problem. You know, knowledge is power, but you know, we don't collect data in the right way, and we don't link it in the right way. There are reasons for that, but often it's just simple things like systems not talking to each other. But there are a lot of other reasons, like, you know, people not wanting to, for some reason, it might be a privacy issue, but often it's just a sort of power thing, I think, saying, this is my data, I'm not going to let you have a look at it, it's crazy. When the person who owns the data, who I think should own the data, i.e. the patient, doesn't have a say. Looking at the way they pay doctors in hospital, providing funding, doctor compensation on either a global budget for, say, diabetes care for a year or something like that, or pay for performance. You know, did your patients bounce back into hospital within 3 days of discharge? And if they did, you didn't get paid. You or the hospital didn't get paid. There's a certain company in this country that's trying that at the moment. I think their PR has been absolutely abysmal. But personally, I actually think the idea behind it is probably quite a good one. But we'll see what happens. Reallocating roles, that's looking at other people doing medical stuff. Drug purchasing, big contracts for drug purchasing. I mean, we pay crazily for some of our drugs. We'd save $1 billion a year if we paid the same amount of money to Pfizer as the New Zealanders do for Lipitor. Some tax issues that they changed, where they put this health care benefit tax into income tax. So it can be done. They're doing well. Okay, quick on the solutions. They're not easy, but they are possible. I think new educational models using simulation, it's the new models of care that we've talked about, the productivity gains that are technology driven, looking at appropriate funding models. We just do not do that. We really need to, now with chronic disease being such a big part of the system, we need to be much smarter about how we pay individuals, pay groups of doctors, whatever. And then this issue about community engagement and shifting from health to health. And these are the things that I want to see. This is 2025. I think we'll have a health system which is primarily salaried in all sorts of ways. People don't understand, I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but the Americans, there are more salaried docs in America than there are non-salaried. And this is supposed to be the sky of, the place for private medicine. I mean, but it's interesting, I mean, a lot of those doctors, or most of the doctors, are employed by the big companies like Kaiser Permanente or the big hospitals, but many of them are on one-year contracts. They're not bad contracts, but they're one-year contracts, you know, and you've got to perform. God. We'd be run out of town if we suggested that at the Royal Melbourne Hospital or at Epworth, where I'm actually on the board, conflict of interest. Anyway, we need to be generalist focused. We've got to move away, and we've got to remunerate generalists as well as or better than specialists. And we've got to have more care coordinators. We'll have care coordinators, lots of care coordinators, patient navigators. We will really have grasped this issue about team care, and you know, we may well, that may be one of the funding mechanisms. You fund the team, not just the individual. There will be absolutely virtual communication between health professionals and between health professionals and patients. It'll be done on these things, on really smart phones, iPads, whatever you want. And there'll be these simple communication platforms. Some of them, I mean, some of the things that Telstra is doing are pretty much state of the art. They'll have become much more sophisticated, I think, by 2025, but they're there now. We won't have multiple entry points into the system. You know, you'll be able to go to one person or two people, and you'll be able to do the lot. Have any of you seen the video? If the health system, if the airline system work like the health system?
Yes.
You must look at it. If you Google airline system works like a health system, look at it. It's very funny, but it's frightening because it's true. It'll be a seamless system, so primary, secondary, tertiary will all meld together. You won't have to go and, you know, you'll be able to have one data set that spreads across, you know. I mean, I'm going for a procedure next week at Epworth. I know I'm going to be asked exactly the same questions that I was asked a year ago, and a year before that, and a year before that, and I'm on the board. And every time I say, what the hell are we doing? Oh, well, you know, we're working on it. I mean, it's pathetic. these systems will be connected to administrative systems, so you're not getting 50,000 bills. You get one bill which tells you exactly what you've been responsible for, what the health system's going to be responsible for, what Medicare, what your private insurance is going to be. And then there'll be partnerships, and there'll be proper supply chain, so you can actually see where you fit in on the line. I mean, I talk about a what if for surgery. I mean, every day in this country there are people who don't turn up for surgery. Okay, so this is my superannuation. Why don't you get some smart person to set up a what bed? So, because you know the day before that there's going to be a bed available. And if you know that there are three orthopaedic beds up in Cairns or wherever, you might find that there's a couple of patients down in Melbourne who have been on the waiting list for 6 months, but they can, if you get them on a plane tonight, they can have their operation done in Cairns. Now, I know I'm being a bit far-fetched, but, you know, it actually happens in other businesses. It's not rocket science. I told Graham Woody should do that. He thought that I hadn't quite done enough background information. You know, he's the guy that set up What If, and he's a Queensland alumni. Data sharing, transparency, you know, we're just so obscure in this country. It's sad, and I get really angry with my medical practitioners because I still get, they always give me a copy of the letter, but there's still usually at the bottom something that says this letter remains the property of Dr. So-and-so. Hang on. That's my history you've got there. If you want to put it on there, then pay me $100. It's sort of sad. And then coming back, and this is, anybody who's, it's out of print, they're just doing a second edition, but it's a really good book. Eric Topol is a cardiologist, but he's really thought about informed decision making, and it's really this issue about making the captain, making the patient the captain of the ship. Okay, you've got a big crew there, and there's absolutely no reason why the doctor can't be the navigator, but the patient, the captain of the ship, would probably be the patient. Okay? But it's called The Patient Will See You Now. It's a really, really good thing. And then the final thing I'd say about patient participation, and this is to me going to be the game changer, because for the first time ever, it might actually, and we'll have to be very careful about how we bring this in, but we might actually get patients to take some responsibility for themselves. Now, I'm not being unfair on patients, but I've looked after a lot of patients, and you know what, it's very difficult to get people to exercise or to stop smoking or to do this or to do that. But if we really get into patient participation, that first, I'm not the first one that said that, with knowledge comes power and with power comes responsibility. But if patients are going to become responsible for part of their health care, if patients are going to be involved in part of their health care, they need to be responsible for it. So it brings in that issue about, you know, when I'm running the health insurance company, where I actually put some incentives in there to say to the patient, you behave yourself. Now, you know, perhaps we're too free a society to accept that, but I think they're debates we probably need to have. I mean, this has really taken off over the last couple of years. There's an International Society for Participatory Medicine. There's some of the colleges in this country are getting involved in a thing called Healthy Choices. Again, it's still very doctor-oriented. And I just think that, you know, we don't realise until you actually start working with patients how smart they are. I don't mean that frivolously, but I've actually been involved in an international group that's used patients in research for some 20 years now, and it's just made such a difference. We were running this group for nearly 40 years now, and about 20 years ago it was developing ways of measuring disease activity in rheumatic conditions, and we'd been developing all these questionnaires for patients to fill in, and after the three of us who'd set this up after a very long night, I think we said to ourselves, oh God, we've got to produce some more of these questionnaires. And we said, well, we'd never actually asked the patients what they think about the questionnaires. So of course we gave the questionnaires to the patients, shared it with them, and got such fantastic feedback. And now, we held a meeting last year where we flew about 30 patients from around the world to Budapest for this meeting. And if you want to get an endpoint, a measure up now through this very complex epidemiological thing, filter, you have to have had at least 3 patients on your working party for 3 years, otherwise don't even come and talk to us. So that's what can happen, and it's fantastic. That's the elephant in the room. I'll say no more about it, but that's the problem, the health professionals. Healthcare is really important for all of us. It's really important that we have those 3 pillars. It's about service delivery informed by research and teaching. And you need to think about, anybody who's in healthcare needs to think about that. We need to be thinking about this this mix of illness and wellness. And, you know, if you take the I out of wellness and put a WE there, you get wellness. So again, it's not a big change. And we all should be doing mindfulness training. That's a thing I got from the Finn Review. So $2,000 a year if you give 1 hour of mindfulness training each day. So there you go. And all the time, remember that only 50% of what health professionals do helps. 50% is all the other things, your education, your housing. And the big challenge for all of us in this is patient participation, but it's everybody, because the big risk here is that you're going to get the tech smart and the tech unsmart, and so again you've got 2 populations, the haves and the have-nots, and that's not going to help things, because we know it's the have-nots that require more healthcare. And then one of my heroes, it's not about, you know, creativity is just joining the dots really. What I've talked to you tonight is not, there are very few things that I've created, but they're all things that are out there, and it's just a matter of getting people to look a little bit laterally and saying, look, how can we create, how can we join up these dots and get something really value-add to whatever that thing is that's going at the moment, and make sure that it's for everybody. So that's the health system of the future. Extraordinarily exciting, I think.